Welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh, a place to chow down on topics relevant to writers of all kinds.
Hello, and welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh. I'm Marissa, and this is a weekly podcast in which I talk about a wide variety of writing-related topics. And occasionally, I speak to a really cool guest, which is the case this week. I have a really fascinating interview with Matthew Broberg Moffitt that I recorded a week and a half ago. And I just want to mention before I get into the interview with Matthew, I do say some things at the beginning of this interview that may come across as a bit dated, because I spoke to him, well, one night after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol building. And I noticed in the first day or so after it happened, and I mentioned this in the interview, that certain members of the media were not were hesitant to use certain language, such as the word terrorist. Obviously, since then, in the week and a half that has elapsed, there have been a lot of changes. And I am hearing, at least on the news outlets I listen to, CNN, MSNBC, I have heard tougher language used more often. Now, Fox News, OAN, those other networks, I don't watch them, so I have no idea the language they're using. I don't want to imagine the type of language they're using. But at least on the news outlets that I pay attention to, I am noticing a change in language that I didn't see immediately after the attacks on the Capitol. So that might come across as a bit dated. However, I think the gist of what Matthew and I discuss at the beginning of this interview is still very relevant. And unfortunately, I feel that it's probably going to be relevant for some time to come, even though we are getting a new president sworn in on Wednesday of this week. And in my opinion, it is not happening a moment too soon. So anyway, I just want to say that I do apologize if some of the specifics of what I say at the beginning of this interview come across as a bit dated, but I do think that overall, we're going to be talking about this stuff for the foreseeable future. So yeah, so with no further ado, I had this great conversation with Matthew Broberg Moffitt, and I hope you enjoy it. I think there's a lot in here that you can take from it. Enjoy. So my guest this week is Matthew Broberg Moffitt, who's a writer querying several kidlit manuscripts and a cookbook proposal with bylines in Thinknum Media. He contracts as a sensitivity reader, has been a substance abuse counselor, IT consultant, computer repair tech, psychiatric tech, trained chef, and even briefly, a Buddhist monk. When not writing, he collects hobbies, the most recent being drumming and the electric bass guitar. Matthew, thank you so much for being on my show. I'm so happy to have the opportunity to speak to you. I've wanted to have you on for a while. I just find you fascinating. When I'm recording this episode, it's on January 7th, which is the day after the insurrection attempt, if that's what you want to call it, or attempted coup, or whatever you want to call it, at the Capitol building. It feels kind of weird doing a podcast about writing at this time. And I've been seeing on Twitter the last 2 days, some people are saying, we still need art. And other people are saying, well, you know, usually I can talk about art, I can write about art, but this time now, I'm sorry, I can't talk about writing. I am going to talk politics now. And I'm just wondering if it's okay if I bring this up first thing, how you feel about that. Like, what as writers should we be, or any type of artists, what do you think we should be maybe doing right now, or maybe channeling our energies into, or like, how do you see that?
Well, first, thank you for letting me be here.
Oh, you're totally welcome. Thank you for coming on my show.
I feel as though as artists, especially as writers, I think people, especially writers themselves, forget that writing is a talent that not everybody shares. In fact, quite a few people are completely devoid of this talent.
Right. Right.
You know, I don't know how many times, you know, I've been part of a team that has determined that as a writer, it was my duty to create basically every written medium.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, I can't count that because it's happened so many times, not because I can't count that high. So.
Right, yeah.
So what I'm looking at here is that, you know, writers, artists of all colors of genre and medium and expression, you know, specifically through this political turmoil, we have a duty to try to shift the perspective,
right?
To be a focus, a lens through which to see this world, partly because if you know, turn to Fox News or any other extremely conservative and biased perspective, they have a team of people that are doing just that.
Right.
You know, their job is to look at world events and creatively interpret them in a way that inflames and agitates their listeners and viewers. And my belief is that there has to be some counter to that.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, actually a true counter to it, not a counterpoint where we have, you know, a likewise twisting interpretive narrative of the facts. However, I want to see a focus, a precision to cut away some of the niceties that have become part of the narrative, the both sides, the that really muddle it down and water it down when conservative think tanks and forces aren't bound by those same restrictions, and they're reaping all of the benefits from it.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good point.
And I feel as though right now, you know, I don't know, have you been following, you know, Dan Rather and
I do. I end up retweeting a lot of Dan Rather's stuff because he's still amazing. I mean, he just nails it. Like, he's just so right on so many things.
And AOC.
Yeah.
They have both. And it's interesting because they're on such diametrically different demographics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yet they channel the energy that I feel really needs to be embraced.
Exactly.
And that is, you know, stop dithering. It's not a debate.
Yeah.
What's going on or what has been going on. You know, we have one group that's fascist and tries to take away the rights of others and is not interested in bettering the lives of Americans or anyone else in the world. And we have another party that, you know, does the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I've really enjoyed, I guess, not enjoyed, perhaps that's too inappropriate of a word, I have found the term death cult to be particularly apt when describing.
Yeah, me too.
The mentality. So.
Yeah.
And I know that that's like, you know, the opposite sounds very hippie, but, you know, if wanting to see American people have a living wage, the disabled have access and not be plunged into subsistence.
Yeah.
That barely scrapes by. If people of all walks of life have untethered access to healthcare.
Yeah.
I guess if those things are heavy, then, you know, peace and love.
Exactly. Exactly. Nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just, you know, I really feel, I mean, there is a place, of course, for destructive art or, you know, art that helps release or relieve anxiety. I really feel that's yeah. also got a place. But I think part of the failure of the Democratic Party, of a lot of media-driven forces, is that they can't grasp the PR element of this.
Yeah.
We need sound bites that are true, that catch, that people can hear. How can yeah. we not have ads driving home, Republicans don't want you to have $2,000 to survive?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's got to be a succinct, clear, and catchy way to deliver that.
Exactly.
I mean, it just boggles the mind.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
And I feel like it's the exact opposite of slinging mud
yeah.
when all you're doing is wiping the mud away and showing the facts.
Yeah, that's excellent what you just said. I mean, that just captures it, I think.
It's not having a message that's interpreted as negative by some people isn't the same as having a negative message.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think you're dead on with that. That's amazing that you just said that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I appreciate you going into all that. I really felt that was something that needs to be addressed, because this is just such a, you know, just such a turbulent time. And I think that you can definitely look at writing and other forms of art as a way of coping. I've already seen some amazing poetry on Twitter based on everything that happened yesterday. And I think this is also a really good opportunity to get into more of what you were saying, for writers to just look at the type of language that's being used in these news stories. Like, I was even getting frustrated yesterday watching, these men are terrorists to me. And it took some of these news anchors a very long time to actually come out and use that word. And it was driving me crazy, because I'm like, they're terrorists. I mean, you can call them other things too, but they're definitely terrorists. And they just do not want to use that word when it's applied to white men. Now, they don't seem to have that problem with African-American men or Middle Eastern men, but white men, no, you can't call them terrorists. And they were mostly white men storming the Capitol. And some of these news anchors just did not want to use that word. And it's just so frustrating. Same thing with the word looting. Now, we use looting when it's used in conjunction with, like, say, I heard it used during coverage of the Black Lives Matter protests. But here were these men coming into the Capitol yesterday, stealing podiums, stealing all this other shit. And how often did you see the word looting in those stories?
Right. It's, and how often did you see the word rioting?
Exactly.
They said, you know, protesting or...
Yeah.
Violent protest.
Yeah. Instead of like coup, they could have used the word coup more, or insurrection or something like that.
It's seditious activities.
Exactly.
I mean, there's not a lot of ways to look at it that shows that the messages are being delivered in a actually unbiased manner, because what they choose to say reveals bias.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point.
Language, you know, has very much an opportunity cost involved with it. Because it's not just what we say, it's what we don't say.
Right.
If you have the chance to speak and what you're saying isn't revelatory or isn't showing a perspective that one could say even the majority of people have,
right,
then you're using your privilege to speak in a disingenuous manner.
Yeah.
And that's, we are far beyond the point where that is acceptable.
Exactly.
And so coming back to, you know, this is a writing podcast. However, we can't ignore the fact that right now, this country is in chaos.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And again, to do so is entirely disingenuous. I write mostly children's literature.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, so I'm glad you brought that up.
So to me, it's like, you know, I write a lot for 4 to 8 year olds.
Okay.
So, except for modeling some principles, like, you know, sharing is good.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking up, I know that Miranda Paul has an excellent picture book on speaking your mind. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's like very distressing.
Oh, don't worry about it. That happens to me too.
Because I speak up, yes. Speak up, an excellent picture book. And so, I mean, the opportunities that I have, however, are often a little bit more sparse when it comes to political narrative.
Right, yeah.
So I feel like it's even more important that any platform or any opportunity that I have to actually speak to truth is utilized.
Yeah.
Because I know that especially when I first started, working on writing that I actually meant to share with the world, that I was very concerned about perhaps, losing followers over speaking something that might be too inflammatory.
Yeah.
And I think that internally the resolution was that if I'm going to be somebody who speaks to children in any way, that what I say has to be authentic.
Yeah, yeah.
And I look back at Mr. Rogers and think, you know, he would be kind, but he would speak the truth.
Yeah.
And I can't see myself, you know, aspiring to be less like Mr. Rogers. That's just not...
Yeah, exactly.
That isn't in the agenda, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
So, I mean, anything I can do to speak my inner truth, and I do believe I do so in a way that is as respectful as one can be.
Yeah, yeah.
Given the times. I feel it's important to seize it.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Like, even me, I hardly ever use profanity on, like, social media. And I just, the last few days, it's just taken everything out of me. Like, I've just had it with so many things. So, like, I think people are kind of seeing a side of me that they might not have seen before, but I like to be as respectful as possible, as much as possible, but things have just gone too far now. But,
right.
Yeah, but I do think in this, at the same time, there is still this need to kind of keep our heads about us and remember that this fight, we're probably going to have to be in it for the long haul, and it's better to just kind of, you know, kind of, I don't want to say relax or anything like that, we can't do that, but just kind of remember that we might still have to examine some of the things we say or how we come across. Like, maybe right now tensions are high, but we might need to calm down for a while and be polite again, and not polite, but just as polite as we can be considering. So, right. I think that's a constant balance that we have to walk, but it's good if we're cognizant of that. And, another thing, like you were just saying about writing for children, when you're writing for children, I think what you said about, being as authentic as possible is very important, because kids can tell if you're authentic or not. As they grow up, it gets kind of knocked out of them, and they, you know, they see more fake people and they feel that they need to be that way. But when they're kids, they have a pretty good idea of who's authentic and who's not. So I think that's a really good point that you made. But how did you get interested in writing for children? Was it something that always interested you, or just you kind of felt like a natural, like, I don't know, you just wanted to write when you were a kid, or like, how'd you get involved in that?
Well, the writing for children is a more recent, or to within the last 2 years, occurrence. Although writing and reading has always been a passion of mine, I have hyperlexia, and I taught myself to read when I was 3 years old.
Oh, wow.
With a copy of Stephen King's Dragon's Eye that my mom had lying around.
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine reading that at that age.
And then my second book that I read right after that was It.
Oh, my God.
So, that may explain some things about Matthew. Just saying. And I have always consumed a lot of fantasy and sci-fi and a lot of the classics. I read around 2,000 words a minute. So,
oh my God.
I have a tendency to essentially like consume books and other written mediums. And I've always enjoyed writing. World building has always been a favorite hobby of mine. I was deeply invested into, you know, Dungeons and Dragons as a child.
Yeah.
And Magic the Gathering and the world associated with it. And I think that, I mean, I would have these elaborate worlds filled with characters and history and magic and culture. And occasionally they would make it to, like, you know, an actual narrative format.
Right. Yeah.
But for the most part, my favorite part was just the creation when I was, you know, younger. What came about for writing for children was actually when I was homeless in 2019.
Oh, wow.
And it was after a very sudden and unexpected divorce.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. And I found myself in a homeless shelter, and I'd spent a lot of time in a homeless shelter as a child.
Oh.
With my mom. I remember specifically, I guess I had written for children before. When I was 8, 9 years old, I was in a shelter for battered women and families with my mom.
Yeah.
And I had drawn a really silly, derpy flamingo that I named Flannery.
Oh.
And the shelter staff helped me create basically a newsletter for the other kids. And I would take this flamingo and he'd be in these silly adventures, basically a really poorly drawn comic.
Yeah.
Because I still can't draw to this day. And I would, have this distributed to the other kids and families, and they seemed to like it.
Yeah.
So this ties back to the shelter recently, a year and a half, 2 years ago, was when I was looking at children who were living in the shelter, and I started thinking about my time when I was a child. And I remembered clamoring.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? There's not a lot of stuff out there for kids in shelters.
Yeah.
Not a lot of media, books, representation, anything. And I was like, you know what? Maybe Flannery might be able to help some people today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I started writing the first Alan and Flannery the Flamingo picture books on a bunk in a shelter surrounded by 200 homeless people.
Wow.
And just as an aside, I actually, as of the 4th, am represented for Flannery.
Oh, that, congratulations.
Yes. With the incredible Hannah Van Vels with Bel Castro Agency.
Wow.
So that's, hopefully someday soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Flannery will get a chance to help some kids not be so scared.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think definitely, I think that book is needed on so many levels for these kids. I think that's really fantastic. Wow, I don't even know what to say except congratulations. This sounds like a really amazing project. If it would be okay if I could ask you a little more about the process of finding the agent, like how that came about.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I wrote a bunch of stuff really fast.
Okay.
And some of the stuff in the beginning wasn't really that great, but it served as a good framework.
Exactly.
So I'm just going to say, starting off, the actual process for me from writing to finding an agent has not really been as long as it has been for a lot of people.
Right, yeah.
And I am blessed in that it was a fairly relatively quick process for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I first joined Twitter in October of 2019.
Yeah.
When I was still in the shelter.
Yeah.
The day that I joined Twitter was for DV Pit.
Okay, yeah.
In fact, that was the whole reason why I was signing up.
Yeah.
And what's amazing is that I didn't find out about DV Pit until essentially the same day. So I found out about it. So, okay, you know what? I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
And started an account, started pitching and messed up a bunch of stuff and didn't do it right. Didn't get a single like or anything or agent or feedback or attention.
Yeah.
But I kept at it and found the writing community a little bit more, in depth, a little bit more helpful.
Yeah.
I kept at it. And then the next writing pitch event, which I think was PitMad.
Okay, yeah.
About a month afterwards. For PitMad, I submitted my pitch for Flannery the Flamingo and got like 3 likes.
Yeah.
From agents, which means that they want to see your work, for those who don't know what that means.
Exactly, yeah.
So you send your picture book writers, you just send your manuscript over because it's only like 500 words. So
yeah,
it's not like, you're just sending them a 50,000 word or 100,000 word manuscript and saying, hey, read this.
Yeah. yeah.
So it was really exciting because that second pitch event for PitMad, I had one of the most retweeted picture books of the day. I'd only been on Twitter for less than a month.
That's amazing.
I've now been on Twitter for a little bit over, you know, about a year and 3 months, and I have around 8,500 followers.
Yeah, yeah, that's good.
And I feel like, you know, a lot of that is due to, you know, pictures of cats and cooking. But
yeah, yeah, both of them are amazing. Like Matthew posts a ton of pictures of both cats, and your food always looks delicious. I've complimented you on pictures of your food on your, and on your cats as well, but I mean, you just post such amazing photos.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I do my best. I am a trained chef, as I've never been able to work in the food industry because of my food aversions.
Right.
But I, you know, went to good old culinary school.
That's amazing.
And, you know, just to kind of go back to the querying part of that, I started submitting to a bunch of agents and a couple of publishers, and I started to get fairly quickly some positive feedback.
Right.
From agents. You know, I got a couple of R&Rs fairly quickly, revise and resubmits.
Okay.
On a couple of different manuscripts. In fact, I had one on a manuscript I wrote for called Graveyard Hamsters.
Oh, okay. I like the sound of that.
Well, it's a real life phenomenon. It's actually, there's a really great video if you do a search on Graveyard Hamsters and Austria. You'll see a BBC video that takes you to a graveyard in Austria that wild hamsters are thriving by eating candles and cut flowers.
Oh my God, I gotta check that out.
Yes, it's. I highly encourage that you take a look at that. Anybody take a look at that. There's some adorable videos of, you know, hamsters eating candles, getting caught in candle jars. Like,
oh my gosh.
I remember seeing that video. Somebody tweeted it, and I was like, oh my God, this is going to be a great picture book.
Oh, my. Oh, wow.
And I was very happy with that one. The main character is a non-speaking character.
Yeah.
And so part of their journey is going into a graveyard, which they live next to and they're very afraid of.
Yeah.
To rescue their very own pet hamster, Nico. And, you know, I'm really excited about it. Which is great because Hannah's is just going to help me get it submission ready.
That's great.
I'm really excited about it. Along with a bunch of other ones, I also have some picture books for with an autistic main character. I am autistic.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of the experiences that I've written for my Remy series are literally right from my childhood.
Yeah.
Like, Remy won't eat squishy.
Okay.
One title.
Yeah.
Remy is a super reader.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just, you know, some very exciting. I have quite a few different manuscripts that I'm very excited about.
Yeah, I would be too. I mean, that it sounds like all of these books are needed. There's so many kids that need books like this, and I think even adults could probably get something out of them too.
Oh yes, I especially with the Alan and Flannery the Flamingo, it's gone a lot of different iterations since I first started writing it. But recently, the one that I found that tells the story the best is kind of a blend of a graphic novel and a chapter book.
Yeah.
So it's longer than a standard picture book, but it's like not really very long for a chapter book.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
No, that does make sense. Yeah.
And it's got, I think the most important part of it is it's a story told in two art styles.
Oh, wow.
And I'm very passionate about this particular part because so much of the story, especially the first part of it, takes place in Alan's imagination or his mind's eye theater.
Wow.
And because of that, it's really hard to show a progressive linear narrative when you're being read to in bed.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine.
So what I really fell into was, you know, the real world with Alan and Mom and Larry is, you know, a kind of mundane, maybe a little banal in terms of art. But then when you see Alan's imagination, it's like vibrant and fantastical, kind of, you know, comic book, Tony DiTavizzi and elements, a lot of incredible depth.
Yeah.
And I feel like that really helps capture and helps reframe, which is the most important part of the narrative.
Yeah. No, this all sounds really, really great. I mean, you just seem like you have so many ideas, and they're all fantastic ideas. So, I wish you a lot of luck with all of them. I really look forward to seeing them. And I think it's great that you have this agent that, Hannah, who is working with you on this. What would you say to a writer who is looking to get an agent? I know PitMad, I do hear about good things happening, but then I also see warnings from some other writers about submitting queries or, you know, maybe people contacting them and saying they're agents and then they turn out not to be that way. What do you think a writer who's maybe looking to do? I'm not sure when the next PitMad is. Is it a few times a year or is it just once a year?
I believe it's four times a year, three or four.
Okay, yeah, I think you're right. I think I did hear about that. I couldn't remember. But if a writer wanted to do the next PitMad, what would you suggest that they maybe keep in mind for doing it? And maybe what should they do? What would you recommend they not do?
Okay, I would say if you do get a like from an actual person who's representing themselves as an agent or a publisher.
Right.
You know, make sure you do your due diligence.
Okay. Yeah, that's important.
I mean, anytime I got a like, I immediately Googled them. You know, there are some people out there that have very nice websites, but they haven't actually, you know, apprenticed in the literary agency world.
Right.
They have, you know, one might say good intentions.
Yeah.
I don't believe that the majority of those people are attempting to take advantage of others.
Right.
I believe that they are, again, well-intentioned, and they might even be helpful at times.
Yeah.
And there are some very nice people that fall into that category.
Yeah.
And it's really important that you try to find the people to represent you that have kind of like, I don't want to say pedigree because that sounds...
No, yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you kind of want to see that they were taught by somebody with connections who knows the world, because literally an agent is your guide.
Right.
They are there to navigate through some terrain that you as an unagented author cannot.
Exactly.
And the way that they do this and how they do that is through their knowledge, their personal connections to editors at publishers, and that stuff, unfortunately, that one can't gain through osmosis.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you could find someone that actually has the requisite experience, knowledge, and just, I hate to say connections, but it really is.
I agree, yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, literary agents are the gatekeepers of the publishing world.
Yeah.
And some of that is, you know, I wish that there were more literary agents and editors of color from other marginalized backgrounds, so that representation is more expansive across the board. That things, you know, like speakers or people involved in fascist regimes weren't given million-dollar book deals.
Yeah. There's one in particular that I heard about in the last day that,
It would be really nice if instead of that, they went in, like, you know, a different direction and maybe helped elevate and give a platform for somebody with a voice that is marginalized and hasn't been heard a chance to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they have all these calls to disadvantaged or marginalized authors to to submit with own voices. There are all of these calls all over publishing for more representation.
Yeah.
But they need to actually put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah.
Because that's how you show that you actually believe something.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're willing to put your marketing empire behind your statement and actually put heat behind what you're doing.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's everything you said is so important. Yeah, that's really great. I want to thank you for talking about that. I've been wanting to talk about, because I've never participated in a PitMed, but I've been wanting to really talk about it on this show for a while, and I'm glad you went into it, because I think it's a great opportunity for writers, but I think that, you know, there's also some good things to keep in mind. And I think you addressed a lot of really good points there.
I was very blessed. I participated in probably 9 different pitch events, and I only went 2 without agent mics.
Yeah.
Every other one I had multiples.
Wow.
So part of it is by everything I say, please, if anyone's going to participate in a pitch event, you've got to have a brilliant pitch. I just can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, work with someone else. Work with somebody who's not a writer. Just read it to them and see if they get it.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's a huge opportunity. It really is. I met Hannah initially through a pitch event.
Yeah.
And she wanted to see 3 of my manuscripts. And she sent me back brilliant feedback and asked for an R&R on Graveyard Hamsters and then gave me more information when I submitted back. And I was very distraught when it was a no. And she actually took the time to talk to me and reassure me, because I was, you know, I'm on Twitter and I'm kind of, I've got a voice in the writing community. And I was like, you know, I'm really distraught. I'm really crushed right now. And she DM'd me and said, you know, you're just not quite there yet, but I really think you're going to be. And your voice and what you have to say is so important. Don't give up.
Yeah, that's great.
And I spent the next several months pitching and revising and working and pushing really hard. And I never gave up. I just kept going and going and going. And then I now have her as an agent.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I think she sounds like she really, really appreciates what you have to offer and wants to work with you to just get it out there to as many people. And I think that's really amazing. So, again, congratulations on that. I mean, that's really, really fantastic. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the cookbooks too. Like, I'm really intrigued. Like, what's that process like?
Okay, that's an entirely different process.
Yeah, I was thinking. Yeah, yeah.
There isn't much I can say right now because I'm in the stage where I can't say much.
I totally understand.
However, there might be some news on this issue next week. Just saying.
Okay. That's fine. That's fine.
Good news. Just saying. Good.
That's good. Yeah, I'm glad.
So I've pitched a couple of cookbooks, and I've got two ideas that I'm really working with that I'm really fond of. But one of them that came more recently is my baby. It's like just as important to me as Alan and Flannery of the Flamingo, which is like saying a lot. If I had two hearts and I was a Time Lord from Doctor Who, these would be those hearts.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty big. Yeah.
And the concept is color, taste, and texture, cooking for food aversion or for autism and food aversion.
Wow, that's great.
And part of it is I've done so much research on seeing if this was provided or a niche that was really filled. And a lot of the autistic cookbooks out there are more ableist.
Yeah.
But they're basically like, you know, if you don't give your children gluten and give them this instead, they won't have severe autism symptoms.
Yeah.
Which is like a little offensive. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I digress.
No, I think that's a good point. I've heard because I used to work with students who had learning differences, and a few of them were autistic. So I'm aware of a lot of these things. And actually, I was going to ask you a little bit about like writing for communities like the neurodiverse community and things like that. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
It's in a way, I wasn't diagnosed with autism until I was 37.
Okay.
So, of course, I had it my whole life.
Right.
But partly because I am articulate and in general, people enjoy being around me.
Yeah.
But a lot of that is because of extreme. I was a counselor, as I mentioned earlier. So a lot of what I do is a learned behavior.
Right.
It's, you know, what I've adapted from counseling technique and strategy to personal experience. It is my way of masking.
Right.
So to kind of go there, you know, I didn't know exactly what it was. I mean, it's now looking back, it's kind of like, how did this go unnoticed for so long?
Yeah.
But that being said, with the cookbook and with, you know, my Remy series of picture books and Graveyard Hamsters, which ostensibly has an autistic coded main character, it's important to me that stories are told that aren't about suffering.
Right. Yeah.
That it isn't where, you know, an autistic child has to overcome their autism.
Yeah.
Where it's simply as to kind of tie into writing for the neurodiverse or autistic community, that it's it's impossible to separate the autistic brain from any of these processes.
Right. Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the, you know, opposition to person first language with regards to autism comes from. In that it's not, I'm not a person with autism, I'm an autistic person.
Right.
Because it's so intrinsic to everything I see and do.
Yeah.
So when I was looking at writing this cookbook, I spoke to a lot of autistic people and parents of autistic children, mostly autistic people, and looked at my own personal experiences. With it's so important that the book not be a way of tricking people with food aversion.
Yeah.
It's not, and I have a line in my intro to the book is, if your child doesn't like the taste and the smell of onions, stop putting onions in their food.
I'm not a fan of onions, so I appreciate that, definitely.
Here's the part that where, however, if your child has a problem with the texture of onions, that's something I can work with. That's something I can help you with.
Yeah.
I'm not, my job or my goal isn't to slip something by this child.
Yeah.
My goal is to honor and respect their preferences.
Yeah.
And to have an attitude of radical and enthusiastic acceptance of it.
Yeah.
Because so much trauma is associated with food.
Yeah.
When it becomes a chore, when it becomes a punishment, when it becomes a reward, all of these things create a trauma-based psychology or pathology.
Yeah.
And I remember I was speaking to a pediatric psychologist and neonatal psychologist about this. And I was saying how I really want to try to help to keep from at least one kid having some of the trauma that I experienced as a child.
Yeah.
With food. And she said that fully one third of her day professionally is spent managing the trauma associated with food in clients.
Yeah.
And patients. I mean, that's, so to me, this isn't just a matter of, hey, here's some really cool techniques to, you know, not get chewy food.
Yeah.
It's, this can actually help save some children's lives.
Yeah.
And it could open up a world of acceptance and growth for a lot of adults.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That sounds really amazing. I don't even know if I've ever heard of a cookbook like that. So that's just a fantastic idea. I really wish you a lot of luck with that, because that's another book that I really think that a lot of people need, and it's not out there. So I'm really glad you're working on something like that. Wow. That's really amazing.
Thank you.
Another thing I wanted to ask you, if it's okay. I noticed in your bio that you said you contract as a sensitivity reader, and I've only really been hearing about sensitivity readers since I've been on Twitter. If you could just maybe talk a little bit about what they do and how, like, why they might benefit a writer, and how a writer can maybe go about finding one. I don't even know it really enough. I mean, I think I know what they are. I haven't worked with them, so I'm not too familiar with. It's like something I understand in theory, basically. So
right, I kind of get how an engine works, but
yeah, exactly. That's me.
You don't want me explaining it to someone.
Yeah.
Well, I've been doing sensitivity reading for a year now, through a wonderful company called Salt and Sage Books.
Okay.
And they kind of serve as a intermediary between the writer and the sensitivity reader.
Right.
So they create a profile, and if you're a writer and let's say you're writing about an autistic person,
yeah,
but you yourself are not autistic,
right,
and it's important that you maintain this character in your story,
yeah,
for there's lots of reasons, but you want to make sure, you know, maybe they're a secondary character or who knows, you want to make sure that what you're talking about, how they're being treated in the world, is authentic,
right,
and not offensive.
Yeah.
And the way I look here is not intentional, unintentionally offensive.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stories out there that utilize, you know, people do experience trauma. Trauma is real. It's in the world. We can't have art that pretends that it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
However, there's a difference between accurate representing of real world events and being unintentionally offensive to autistic people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or other people from different backgrounds or marginalized experiences. And I feel like that's where a lot of people get kind of meshed up or a little mixed up, where they're like, oh, well, I'm trying to tell a story how it really happened. If I'm using, you know, different language in a book that's written in the 70s, it's not going to be authentic.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like there's a difference between having authentic linguistic representation.
Yeah.
And being unintentionally offensive or hurtful.
Yeah.
Entirely. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So when you contract for a sensitivity reader, you may say, okay, I'm writing such and such book. I would like for you to read to see if there's any issues with, like I'm also non-binary, if there's any issues with a non-binary assigned male at birth.
Right.
Character.
Right. Yeah.
Can you tell me if this reads well to you?
Yeah.
And I would then read through it, and if they've identified anything in particular that they're concerned about, then I'll pay particularly close attention to see if that is an issue.
Yeah.
But I'll also look to see that they're not a punchline.
Yeah, that's important.
That the story is being told with them and not at their expense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's so much, there's a lot of stuff out in this world that's pretty hurtful.
Yeah.
To a lot of people.
Yeah.
And generally the people that contract sensitivity readers are not the people that perpetuate that.
Yeah.
By and large, the people that contract sensitivity readers have already generally done a fairly good job of screening their work. They may have just missed a couple of things, or there's a couple of parts that are a little thin or could use more authenticity.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the people that really need sensitivity readers are the people that would never hire them.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. Yeah.
It's unfortunately got a, what is it? Confirmation bias?
Yeah.
Thing going on
here. Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I was thinking that.
However, I mean, I've contracted for, you know, a number of pieces. Some of them have been published or on their path to publishing.
Yeah.
And it's very rewarding work. It's very difficult at times.
Yeah.
It's very emotional. A lot of it is trying to express appreciation, because it is a big deal for an author to contract a sensitivity reader that you're paying to make sure that you're not being hurtful.
Yeah.
Or perpetuating stereotypes that you are unintentionally giving.
Yeah.
So part of what I feel is it's really important as a sensitivity reader is to pay, to give honor to that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, ultimately, it's an ideal behavior. I mean,
yeah,
it's an ideal attitude. I mean, pretty much I feel every single work that's published, printed, directed, shot, filmed, whatever, should probably go through an independent sensitivity reader.
I agree. I totally agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, especially when you think of Sia, that autism farce.
I totally agree with you. I think it's going back to what you said. A lot of the people that probably need the most would never think of it, or they'd never want it. But I definitely think it's a good service, and I'm glad I know about sensitivity readers now. I was going to a writing group for a while, and you know, we would all kind of read our works to, you know, each other, but I don't think anybody there was really a sensitivity reader, so, you know, there was a lot of stuff that, wasn't picked up.
And I feel like, you know, it is, sensitivity of reading is work.
Yeah.
It is, like, at times, very difficult.
Yeah.
Because it's emotional labor.
Yeah.
A lot like being a counselor, I speak from experience. There are some elements to it that are similar on the emotional burden of it.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, you're reading for cultural trauma. Like I read for Romani because I have Romani heritage.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And you're looking through a lens that is searching for that trauma.
Yeah.
To see how it is being illuminated, how it's being illustrated, if the cultural representations are authentic and have a ring of truth to them.
Yeah.
And that's why it's really important, you know, that if you have a sensitivity reader, you know, that they're compensated for their
I think that's definitely important, yeah. Yeah.
Because it's, again, this is all going back to publishing, asking for disenfranchised voices, the way you show that you care, it's by putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
If it's important, then you put importance behind it. And right now, importance is shown through compensation.
Yeah. I totally agree with you on that.
It could be through barter, if you know someone individually.
Yeah.
That you've agreed upon, you know, or if it's somebody that you're, again, contracting through a company, it's through cash. But otherwise, it's valuable work, so it deserves to be valued and compensated.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I thank you so much for talking about that. I find everything you have to say really fascinating and really helpful to a lot of the listeners of this show. I would love to have you back on again sometime, to maybe after one of your, or maybe after a few of your books come out. I don't know what your publishing schedule is going to look like with those books, but you know, you're welcome to come back on anytime. What you're saying is amazing. It's been really great talking to you. If there's anything you'd like to let my listeners know about, I'm going to be including your bio in the show notes. If there's anything else you'd like me to include or anything else you'd just like to mention now, I want to give you the opportunity to do that.
Oh gosh. Well, now I'm like drawing a blank.
Oh, don't worry about that.
Well, I really appreciate that opportunity. how about this? Wear your damn masks, yo.
I'm totally with you on that. I am totally with you on that.
Once again, I really want to thank my guest, Matthew Broberg Moffitt, for taking the time to talk to me. And I really hope I can have him on the show again in the future. I'm really fascinated by all the different projects he's working on, and there's still so much that I want to ask him. It was just a great conversation. Matthew, from the bottom of my heart, I appreciate you and everything you're doing. Thanks again. And I want to just quickly mention another friend of the show, Tim Boffman Jr. I've spoken to him twice on this podcast, most recently, episode 2 of this current season. Tim's new book, Kotov Syndrome, comes out on January 23rd, which is this coming Saturday. So I am also going to include a link in the show notes to where you can purchase Tim's new book. And Tim, I also want to say I wish you a lot of luck with this book. I'm really looking forward to reading it, and I wish you a lot of success with this book. So yeah, so if you want to purchase Kotov Syndrome, there will be a link in the show notes to purchase it. And please email me at marissadelefarfalle@gmail.com. Whatever you think, I want to hear it. I really appreciate all your feedback and all of your suggestions for making this podcast better. You can also check out my Patreon page at www.patreon.com/MarissaDF. You can follow me on Twitter if you don't already at @MarissaD13 or on Instagram at www.instagram.com/MarissaDF13. I'd also really appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, as it'll help a lot more people find out about the show. So until next time, thank you so much for all of the feedback that you give me and everything that you do to spread the word about this show. I greatly appreciate it, and I'm constantly looking for ways to improve what I do and the content that you get every week. I can't thank you enough for that. So please stay safe and peace out.
This podcast has been brought to you by Anchor, which is the easiest way to make a podcast. Go to anchor.fm for more info.